Hello, and welcome back to Better with Becky, a podcast for anyone on the journey to a stronger self and a better life. Hi, hello, how are we doing out there? We are in that interesting little lull after Christmas and before the new year, where that kind of post-holiday malaise can kind of set in. A friend of mine that I'm Marco Polo with, who's also in Build with Becky, hey Abby, if you're listening, recently referred to this as Rot Week, which I had not heard before, probably because I'm chronically offline. But that does sound about right. And if you're anything like me, after all the festive, happy, hello, thanks, Miss Eving that's been going on, you're hitting a bit of a wall and your body is asking for a little bit of rest and recovery. And I'm just tuning into that, frankly, because I really enjoyed some empty gym time this past week. And I did two major lifts on both Christmas Eve and Christmas Day because we had a very nice low-key holiday here. Just me, Justin, and his brother Jeremy. And we just had a little bit of Disney magic, but otherwise very do what you want when you want, casual, chill vibe. So I went to the gym both days, enjoyed the emptiness. But I've been lifting towards the end of my first bodybuilding block. I'm on my 14th week of kind of going at that top 8, 9, 10 RPE. And my body let me know that was a little too much without a rest day. So then I had to just chill out for a couple days, get a massage yesterday, starting to feel better, but taking another rest day today. So whether you are getting the movement in or maybe taking that much needed recovery like I am, I encourage you to just kind of at least mentally, psychologically, try to give yourself some rest during this week. Because truly, if you think about it, there's nothing going on that matters this week. You know, it's just we all made it through the holiday. The new year has yet to come. So just really try to tune into what your body and mind and heart and whatever just need right now and try to honor that signal. I know that's so much easier said than done. I am very guilty of just continuing to work for no reason. I guess you could argue, why am I cutting a podcast today when I could be doing nothing? But I actually, today, I'm kind of thinking about how during this week, I think because people do tend to maybe finally relax, finally recover a little bit. And so maybe they're moving a little bit less. And then they're also maybe like feeling the special treats and meals and downtime kind of like all add up on their body. And they're maybe starting to feel it a little bit. I think it's natural that that kind of sets the stage for that tendency that as the new year approaches, a lot of us just sort of naturally start thinking about our health and the new year. And while, you know, typically weight loss trends tend to dominate that conversation, if you have seen any of my work or listened to this podcast, you know, my angle is always about gaining health, not shrinking bodies. So in that spirit, today's episode, I wanted to talk actually about alcohol and sober curiosity. And yes, I'm definitely piggybacking on the trend and the fad of dry January. But I want to talk about the idea of taking a break from drinking, even temporarily, or even just drinking less. Some people call that damp January, which I find kind of humorous. But just why that might be one of the most impactful things that you can consider doing for your overall health and well-being. And, you know, ironically, it may actually really further any weight loss goals that you have, but that would very much be a side effect. I'm going to go at this much more from the angle of sharing my own journey. I'm now about 15 months sober, but that did not happen overnight. So in this episode, I want to share my own sober curious journey from kind of a quote unquote failed dry January attempt a couple years back to where I am now, and why that first kind of failed effort actually mattered a lot more than I realized at the time. And that's why I actually am pretty comfortable promoting Dry January, because the truth is, you know, there is no safe level of alcohol, and this is not going to be an episode about detoxing or moralizing alcohol or the decisions that we make around it. It's definitely not about perfection either, or about deciding some kind of identity shift that has to be forever. But it is something that we have plenty of evidence around. And I find often the same folks that are frustrated with their lack of results, or are complaining about not sleeping well, or have kind of unsustainable levels of stress, understandably, but counterintuitively, are kind of band-aiding those things with alcohol. And, you know, every human behavior has a reason. I firmly believe that. I've talked before about how my 15 years in the classroom and observing kids of all ages really taught me that kids do not do or say something without a reason. You may not understand it in the moment, but it always reveals itself later. And I truly believe that unless a person is like a psychopath, which there's a few of those in every classroom as well, don't get me wrong, but unless you are a psychopath, every behavior you are engaging in has a reason to it. It just might not be accomplishing your goal as well as it could be, if that makes sense. So for example, with alcohol, if you're, you know, unsustainably stressed, or it's hard for you to fall asleep, it does in the moment, short term, make sense to have a drink because it takes the edge off. It makes you sleepy. You fall asleep. When it doesn't make sense is 3 hours to 3 days to 3 weeks to 3 months to 3 years later, when chronically you can't fall asleep without alcohol and you wake up at 3 a.m. every night and it's just not serving you in the long term because you don't have other ways of coping with your stress, right? So there are reasons why we resort to these things, but then there's a lot under the hood that we could probably do a lot of thinking about and perhaps find not even a complete cutting out of alcohol, but just a lot of other tools in the toolkit. And that may also lead to quitting alcohol. Just kind of depends on the person and what they're ready for. So I'm going to share, like I said, to start off my own sober curious journey. And then I'm going to share some of the science about why we really probably should pay attention to alcohol and its potential harms for our health, physical and otherwise. Some research and studies will be shared for that as well. And I'll put those in the show notes for you, along with some of my own milestones that I tracked through my sober curious journey. And then I'm just going to kind of talk about Dry January as a potential behavioral experiment for those who are a little bit sober curious, and some book recommendations that I would suggest you check out if you're ready to hop into this challenge in January. But I first want to start with just a quick caveat, and there is no shame to this, but I just want to put this out there because I think for a wide variety of reasons. Like I said, every human behavior has a reason. But for a lot of reasons, alcohol does become a coping tool for a lot of people. So I just want to be very clear that if alcohol has been or has become a daily coping tool for you, or if you've ever experienced physical withdrawal symptoms from trying to stop, so those would include things like shaking, sweating, nausea, maybe severe anxiety when you try to quit alcohol, those are signs that you are kind of physiologically addicted to the substance. And so at that point, it's very important to not just quit cold turkey, but rather to talk with a healthcare professional and make sure that you have guidance of how to step down and eventually, if it's the goal, cut out alcohol. So make sure that you're sharing that with your doctor and not just listening to a podcast and deciding to go cold turkey, because that could actually be very dangerous and people have actually died from that. So a quick caveat there. Okay, so backing up, let's start off just with my own journey, because I think a lot of people probably are drinking alcohol. Like, even if I think of myself a few years ago, one, I was kind of a very late bloomer, both Justin and I were, to drinking alcohol, probably because we went to a Christian college and it was a dry campus. So we just didn't really drink in college. And then when we were, you know, adulting for the first time, I think because we didn't drink in college, we were a little scared to like drink and drive. So anytime there was driving involved, one of us for sure did not drink. And that was honestly up until maybe like 24 years old, at least. Then we kind of had a little phase of getting into craft beer. We lived in Ohio, and that was kind of a part of the culture there. Eventually, fast forward quite a long time, I feel like we started tiptoeing into cocktails, and especially here in Orlando, it's just vacation all the time. So there's no end of places to drink, no end of really cool custom cocktails everywhere. And kind of like how we had to be more mindful about food when we moved to basically Disney World and just all the fun treats you could eat all the time, I realized that I was drinking more than ever. And like, I never really even enjoyed alcohol to begin with. I kind of just did it because it was the thing to do. It was social. It seemed like if you want to hang out with people, they want to go get drinks, or you go to dinner and people get drinks. And so I didn't think explicitly about it, but I was definitely just sort of, I guess, a little bit peer pressured. Obviously, I was a full grown adult. I made that decision, but I didn't think explicitly about it. And I often didn't really want to drink, but it was just kind of what was being done. So I did it too. And then this also coincided with becoming a personal trainer. And I remember kind of thinking like, this doesn't make any sense at all. But at the same time, I was at this kind of part of my own fitness journey where I had such high, what's called NEAT, N-E-A-T, that stands for non-exercise activity thermogenesis. NEAT is basically all the movement that you do that is not an explicit workout in a day. So all the steps you take, the vacuuming, the, wiggling your foot when you have your leg crossed, every little motion that you make burns calories. And when I was a trainer at a gym, I had such high NEAT from, loading my clients' barbells, unloading the barbells, leading group fitness classes, taking everybody on a warm-up walk and a cool-down stretch and doing those things myself to model it for the clients at the gym, that I noticed I could really get away with pretty much anything dietarily. And that even seemed physiologically, at least, because, it's not visual, it's more internal, the physiological impacts of alcohol. But at least like my weight, my body composition, it seemed like it was totally fine for me to be drinking a couple times a week, a couple cocktails every time I drank, eat whatever I want, and I was still at the best body composition of my life. So it just seemed like it didn't matter that much. Then fast forward a couple years, and when I left the gym to start my own company, Better with Becky, and side note, I have a strength training program called Build with Becky. If you're interested in that, you can find it at my website, www.betterwithbecky.com. I believe the next program is coming out January 12th. I'd have to check the calendar to be sure. But anyway, getting back to that career change, when I career changed and was suddenly not burning who knows how many, but a lot of calories every day, just walking around a gym, being a coach, I realized, oh wow, my NEAT has plummeted. I need to explicitly go for walks. I need to do things to increase my activity level just to maintain, let alone if I do have any body composition or maybe fat loss goals, for example. So that was kind of a big wake-up call. Took a few weeks to months for it to like show up on my body and for me to realize like, ooh, I don't love this. I think I'm going to make some changes. And then I think it took a few months beyond that, maybe even a year. Yeah, I think it was about a year because I started Build with Becky kind of spring 2023. And my first attempt at alcohol, like really explicit alcohol reduction, was January 2024, so about 2 years ago, and I decided to try Dry January. And part of why I tried that, and one of the resources that I'll link to in the show notes, is that was the year that, if you remember, WHO, the World Health Organization, came out with a press release that clearly and definitively delineated that there is no level of alcohol consumption that is safe for our health. And this was the first time that they'd kind of, we kind of all knew it wasn't probably great and that there was at least correlation, if not causation. But this was the first time that the World Health Organization definitively came out with a press release, with research, with evidence stating unequivocally that alcohol is a toxic, psychoactive, dependence-producing substance, and that it's been classified as a group 1 carcinogen by the International Agency for Research on Cancer. That it's in the highest risk group, along with asbestos, radiation, and tobacco, and that it causes at least 7 types of cancer, including the most common types, such as bowel cancer and female breast cancer. And basically that ethanol, which is just another word for alcohol, causes cancer through biological mechanisms as the compound breaks down in our bodies. So basically any beverage containing alcohol, regardless of its price or quality, so like really nice red wine, doesn't matter, it still poses a risk of developing cancer. So this was, you know, something that really, to me, was like, oh, okay, thank you. I think I've just kind of been assuming, of course, it's bad for me, but now I have this very clear evidence. I am a trainer. I do want to improve my body composition at this point, a year into sitting more and moving less. Why not cut out alcohol? And I think to myself, that should be fine. I've never really been that into alcohol. I've just been doing it socially, almost like that argument you hear people say about smoking, like, oh no, I'm just a social smoker when I'm out with friends. And I always kind of laugh at that. But I was honestly kind of using that same logic with alcohol, which I now can kind of chuckle at. But at the time, I truly thought, okay, this will be a piece of cake. Dry January 2024. Let's do it. And then I only made it halfway through the month. And that gave me some pause, because I did not think that I was that, I don't want to say addicted, but really, like, what is addiction other than being pulled mentally and physically to consume a substance? And I obviously was pulled to drink it 15 days into the month when it was Justin's birthday. And I wanted to mark that occasion somehow. And it felt like alcohol was the easiest, most accessible way to do that. And he didn't even ask me to have a drink with him. I gave in and did that of my own will without really trying very hard to stop myself. I used that as an excuse. So, you know, it was an interesting situation, because the win was that I learned, okay, I can go a couple weeks without alcohol. Cool. Win. Good to know. I'm not, maybe in my mind, that addicted. And then on the other hand, I also learned, man, that was very, very hard for me. I had a lot of FOMO. I also was trying to be very puritanical about it. So, like, I didn't want to replace, for example, alcohol with a sugary mocktail, because that felt like a crutch to me psychologically or behaviorally. So I was trying to go like 0 to 90 from alcohol to like plain water, nothing else. And it was just too much too soon. And I think there probably were some cravings physiologically, but also just some behavioral stuff, some environmental stuff, some mindset stuff. And ultimately I just gave in, and it didn't stick. And so I could at this point look back on that and say, like, yeah, that's why, you know, 30-day challenges are stupid and don't matter. And why would anybody ever do something like Dry January? But I do not feel that way. Because if you fast forward maybe till October of 2024, so let's see, January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, 9 months later, I go to urgent care because TMI maybe, but I have a UTI. I get antibiotics and they tell me, oh, by the way, don't drink while you're on those for 10 days. And I'm like, oh yeah, no big deal. And it is no big deal, actually. 10 days come and go. And as I get to day 10, I remember kind of thinking, huh, I wonder how long I could go. And this was a little bit different, subtly so, but a little different than Dry January, where I was like, I'm doing Dry January. This is a challenge. I'm like, you know, restricting alcohol. It's bad for me. Versus, oh, I, you know, for my health and well-being, I already haven't been drinking for 10 days. Clearly, I'm capable of this. Just, you know, out of curiosity, keyword, by the way, more on that later. Out of curiosity, how long could I go? And so that's kind of how I approached it the second time around. And interestingly, that's exactly how I've been approaching it up until now, 15 months in. So, you know, at first, about a month in, I remember noticing my sleep improving, both the quantity and the quality of the sleep. And of course, when you sleep better, everything is better. Your stress is lower. Your workouts, you have more energy for them. You recover better from them. When your stress and your training and your sleep is better, it just feels easier to do kind of everything else in your life. There's more balance. And that improves your relationships, and all of that ties into your stress as well. So it's all very interrelated, but really the base of it was the alcohol leaving my system, which, by the way, does take time. I remember one of the books I read, which I'll also link to in the show notes, is called Sober Curiosity. And there's one kind of throwaway line in there about, I believe, for whatever reason, if you take a hair sample from somebody, you can tell whether or not they have consumed alcohol. And that does not go away for, I want to say it was at least 30 days, but it might have even been longer. It might have been like 6 months. And I remember for some reason that stuck in my mind, because I remember thinking like, oh, I don't know why, by the way, but oh, I definitely want to get to the point where my hair shows no sign of alcohol. And I don't know why that stuck with me of all things, but I definitely was of the opinion that I wanted to be like completely alcohol free, even if that meant it wasn't even in like the very tips of my hair, which would take maybe, I don't know if it was 30 days or 6 months. At this point, I'm beyond both of those milestones. But at the time, that felt like it would be a really big accomplishment and milestone. And, you know, sure enough, I shared my journey along the way. So I'll link to all of these in the show notes. But, you know, the first month was a little bit challenging. The second month, I think we were traveling in Japan, and things kind of subtly shifted that month from, it probably helped that we were in Japan, so I was far away from the majority of my social network, but it kind of subtly shifted from FOMO and fear of missing out to what I like to call JOMO, which is kind of the joy of missing out. And I think it was kind of because I was thinking more clearly, and I was more connected with my body and the energy of what I needed moment to moment, day to day. So I noticed that I kind of now took joy in missing out on occasion. And I really only made social plans with people who I wanted to surround myself with, often who were supportive of my fitness and health journey, who didn't make a big deal over alcohol consumption in either direction. And, you know, maybe some other people that I didn't feel that from, there were longer gaps between our hangs. And that was okay, because that probably should have happened anyway, but I just hadn't noticed that kind of the social glue tying our relationships together had been alcohol. And obviously that's not a very firm foundation to build a friendship or a relationship on anyway. So it was kind of like a long time coming in my mind, that once I had maybe the mental space from, frankly, the mental clarity that opened up from whether it's more sleep, better recovery, all these things combined due to the lack of alcohol, I also realized, oh, why would I continue to put myself in environments or cultivate relationships with people that end up putting myself in that situation, which is, you know, not really what I'm going for right now. So that can be, you know, a positive or a negative of a sober curious journey, because you may kind of discover along the way that many of your relationships center around alcohol. And that can be really challenging. I think the same thing happens to some extent with a fitness journey, with a nutrition journey. You realize a lot of times you go out for meals or whatever it might be, or your family has like some really food-centric traditions that aren't really serving you during that phase of your journey, whatever it might be. But I think we also underestimate the power that we have to through our own behavior, provide an alternative to whatever that kind of status quo is. And you never know, honestly, like when you maybe show up and don't drink at an event, sometimes people will ask you why, and it is from a place of judgment, but sometimes they're asking why because they really are curious, going back to that key word, curiosity. And I think they're wondering, oh yeah, what's that like? Is that hard? Could I do that? What would that be like? And when they see you doing it, they realize they could do it too. So don't underestimate the possibility that by doing something like this, you might actually be the role model that a friend or a family member or a work colleague is looking for. And then they might actually have the interest in trying something that helps them and their long-term health and well-being too. Just something to think about there. But anyway, getting back to my journey, I think it was about 100 days in. I think that was actually about this time last year, kind of looking into the new year, that I started to feel more like this isn't really as hard as it used to be. I still occasionally want to drink, but now I have so many other ways to mark milestones and occasions. And at this point, I'm hitting my goals faster. I'm feeling better on all fronts, physically, mentally, emotionally. That's freeing up more bandwidth to be present for other people as well and support them more readily. Around 6 months in, I'll link to all of these in the show notes in case you're curious about these posts. I start noticing a lot of kind of like fitness milestones. So I'm getting PRs at the gym. I'm running a 10-mile race and getting a PR with my running. I'm like trying things I haven't done in quite a while. And I'm kind of thinking back to my past self and realizing, man, that really wasn't a false start with that dry January. I think that was just my former self needing to try this on as a short-term goal to gain evidence that I could do this for longer if I so chose. And I just really had a lot of gratitude to my past self for trying it and seeing what would happen and collecting data along the way and not seeing it as a failure when I decided to drink, but rather seeing it as, wow, I got 15 days. I could definitely do that again in the future if and when I'm ready. And I had noticed in that time between like when I started drinking mid-January to October, and there's some research that I'll share about this later too, that I did drink less after my kind of false start dry January. So before I almost always had two cocktails when I went out. That was kind of my limit for whatever reason. Three made me feel a little unsafe or a little like out of control. I felt like one, I almost didn't feel it and it wasn't like quote unquote worth it to some extent, if that made sense. But after the dry January attempt, I noticed I would generally get one drink and make it really last. And then I would follow it with water or soda or something like that. And the interesting thing about that was that it was kind of like I said, like this almost doesn't feel worth it. Like I'm not getting a buzz at all. I'm not really enjoying the night more with one drink. I'm just doing this because the people around me are doing it or because I have some like self-imposed sense that I need to do this. So I kind of started noticing that, and that was part of the curiosity come October of, oh man, this is kind of just nice to like, in general, I'm not an all or nothing person. I think I've talked about that quite a bit on this podcast and in my content that like, I'm more of an all or something or always something, never nothing, like do what you can, where you can. And I want to state clearly that even less alcohol is great, like a damp January versus a dry January, drinking like one less day a week, anything is going to be better because there is a dose dependent response when it comes to alcohol consumption. So basically, the more you drink, the more the risk rises. So in reverse, the same is true. The less you drink, the lower the risk. So even less alcohol is definitely better. But I also, when I was honest with myself, realized I don't even really enjoy this and nobody around me is like pressuring me to do this. So what am I doing here? And I think around that 6-month mark, without alcohol, I realized, wow, this really isn't challenging at all anymore. And I have all these benefits. Why wouldn't I keep going? And rewind a little bit too. The 100-day mark, which was around this time last year, I forgot to share. When my father-in-law, Fred, passed away last December, he had been alcohol-free for over 30 years. And coincidentally, I had started my second attempt at the Sober Curious thing on October 5th, and that's his birthday. And so suddenly, you know, I was already sober at the time, but was just kind of like, oh man, this now feels a lot more meaningful and a lot more significant to carry this on kind of in his honor. And so again, fast forward a few more months and I hit a year a couple of months ago. And the funny thing about hitting a year sober is I think in my mind when I started a year ago, now 15 months, I thought that would be such a big deal to like hit 1 year and be like, oh my God, wow, I did it. This is incredible. I'm a new person. And in fact, it was like the exact opposite, because by the time I hit a year, it just became part of my identity. It was not a habit I had to engage in. It was not, you know, white knuckling at all. Not that it ever really was for me. I'm pretty lucky that I didn't have that to deal with. But it just was like almost a non-event because it's just who I am now that I don't drink alcohol. So I did make a post about it because it still felt like this would be a cool thing to look back on, to share with other people. But, you know, kind of counterintuitively, the longer I go, the less of a big deal this seems to be. And I honestly probably wouldn't talk about it at all because of that. It's just kind of like a shrug. Oh yeah, I'm Becky. I'm a trainer. I don't drink. But I do know that alcohol is still such a big part of so many people's day-to-day lives, and that it, you know, kind of the structure of maybe their social lives, their stress management techniques, the tools in their toolkits that they have to manage all of the ups and downs of life can really center around alcohol. And there is so much research now about why alcohol matters for health that I kind of feel like it is a little bit of maybe not my duty, but as with anything, when I find research and I try it on myself and then I see benefit from it, it's really hard for me to not share that with other people, because I think just like with, you know, wanting to start a fitness journey or wanting to eat better, I think with alcohol, probably a lot of people are drinking more than they're comfortable with for any reason. Even I was drinking more than I wanted to simply because of my environment and my social life and whatever. So I think there are a lot of people that are kind of, whether consciously or subconsciously, curious about what life might be like with less alcohol, but they don't have an example. They don't have a roadmap and they don't know what it would look like to approach things that way. So I think that my goal in talking about it is not to proselytize or moralize or pressure people into not drinking, but just to share, hey, here's the data. And, you know, understandably, if you're drinking alcohol, you may have some complicated thoughts and feelings that have yet to be processed, because drinking alcohol is a convenient way to numb out from that. And it might be worth taking a little break. And why not do it when you have a lot of social support during something like Dry January, where you, anytime you get the question of why aren't you drinking, it's completely supported and socially acceptable and destigmatized to say, oh, I'm doing Dry January. Everybody understands that. Everybody supports that. Honestly, I think I saw a stat the other day that 25% of the American population plans to engage in Dry January. And at this point, the rates of drinking have fallen enough that only 50% of American adults drink alcohol to begin with. So that means like 50% of people around you are going to be taking a break from alcohol in January. So I think my goal in sharing how I did it, and how even if you know, fall off, I kind of hate that term, but like, you know, let's say you don't make it through. So I did that too. And I still don't regret it, because it was the first step towards ultimately changing my relationship with alcohol. So let's just talk a little bit about the science and why alcohol matters for health. I already shared a little bit from the World Health Organization and how basically the risks of drinking start from the very first drop, and that there's no level that is safe, and it's in that top group one list of carcinogens. So it's one of those things that I think we don't realize that there's such a high risk to what's become a very normalized behavior in our population. We don't realize that there are over 200 million people at risk of developing alcohol attributable cancer, and that this is a very avoidable cause of disease and death. And it's one of those things that, as you realize, especially if you think about the social determinants of health and, you know, different environments and education levels and socioeconomic statuses and just cultural norms, that even more so, disadvantaged and vulnerable populations have even higher rates of alcohol-related death and hospitalization. And there's just so much prevention, or at least improvement, that's possible when it comes to alcohol. And I think we choose to kind of conveniently ignore the bigger picture of alcoholic harm and maybe buy into things like, oh, well, drinking red wine is heart healthy. But the fact is, yes, there's a compound in red wine. I forget how to pronounce it. Resveratrol. There it is. It's a plant compound, resveratrol, found in grapes. Yes, it's used to make red wine. And, you know, there may be some cancer prevention effects, but, you know, researchers have also found that the studies around that were pretty flawed, and that there is actually no association between moderate consumption of red wine and the risk of developing, in particular, prostate or colorectal cancer. Overall, in fact, recent meta-analyses have found no difference between red or white wine and overall cancer risk. And in fact, you know, still overall a tie to cancer development if you're drinking wine. So there's truly just like no form of alcohol, no level of alcohol that is quote unquote safe or beneficial. I think the only argument you could maybe make to that tune would be, well, alcohol helps me relax. And then when I relax, I connect better with people, and social health is really important. And I think that is a little bit of what I told myself as well. And I do think that that ties into like timing and readiness and just like the behavioral side of trying something like Dry January. I think that for me, the first time around, a combination of the fact that Dry January wasn't as popular yet. It was still pretty popular, to be honest, in 2023, but I at least felt like it was harder to find non-alcoholic options a couple years ago versus now. Honestly, there are so many non-alcoholic options that I have yet to try them all. And ironically, the more I kind of allow myself to use whatever crutch and substitute to make it easier to not drink. So, you know, it's actually very common to have sugar cravings if you cut out alcohol. And these days I realized, you know what, I'd actually rather eat my calories than drink them anyway. I'm going to order dessert, or I'm going to get this fun mocktail that has some sugar in it. Now that I allow myself to do those things, because comparatively speaking, they're still a better choice than alcohol. Ironically, I find that I do usually just want water. So a lot of it is kind of psychological and behavioral as well. And some of it's environmental, some of it's just kind of being ready for it. But I think at least with the research that we have now, we can understand that alcohol does actually cause cancer, that it's a class one carcinogen. You know, for example, I'm looking here at some stats and I'll link these in the show notes. This is a fact sheet about alcohol and cancer risk. You're 2 times as likely to get liver cancer if you're a heavy drinker. In light drinkers, even, you're 1.04 times as likely to get breast cancer, 1.23 times as likely if you're a moderate drinker, and 1.6 times as likely if you're a heavy drinker. And that's partly due to the fact that we create more estrogen in the body when we drink alcohol, and estrogen is cancer promoting, unfortunately, as a hormone. So, you know, making that a little bit easier to understand, among, let's say, 100 women who have less than one drink per week. So that's like very little. That's less than I was doing when I was like getting very close to going sober curious. 17 of them will still develop an alcohol related cancer. That's from the Surgeon General Advisory Report. So that's pretty crazy. Like maybe you're only having like half a drink every couple weeks. Still 17 out of 100 women will develop an alcohol related cancer. Let's bump that up to like one drink a day. Let's say you have like a glass of wine every night. 19 out of 100 women will develop an alcohol-related cancer. And let's say you have 2 drinks a day, a couple glasses of wine, that number bumps up to 22. So almost 25% of women who are drinking a couple drinks a day will develop an alcohol-related cancer. Not like might develop, not correlation, causation. From the Surgeon General Advisory. So that's, you know, pretty compelling evidence, pretty shocking, and I think something worth paying attention to if we're valuing our health and well-being. Looking at a similar guide from Canada's Guidance on Alcohol and Health, this one's very nice, kind of like accessible language, I would say. Some key points from their report, and I'll link to this one as well, is that there's kind of a continuum of risk. So this is what I mean by a dose-dependent response. Basically, 0 drinks per week. Not drinking has a plethora of benefits, including better health. We'll talk more about specifics in a moment, and better sleep. 2 standard drinks or less per week. So maybe like Friday night, you go out on a date night, you have a couple drinks with your partner. You're likely to avoid alcohol-related consequences for yourself or others at this level. Keep in mind, this was put out in 2011, so this is actually a little behind. But still, even in 2011, it was not like you're fully likely to avoid consequences. 3 to 6 drinks per week, which I don't think is that many for a lot of people, if we're honest with ourselves, because that's like a couple drinks a couple times a week, which I think is fairly standard, whether you're drinking at home or going out with friends. Your risk of developing several types of cancer, including breast and colon cancer, increase at this level, and now we know at all levels. 7 or more drinks per week, your risk of heart disease or stroke increases significantly. And then basically each additional standard drink radically increases risk of alcohol-related consequences above 7 drinks per week. So again, just some really compelling evidence to think about if you're somebody who cares about your health and well-being physically. Obviously, even like knowing this information could be kind of mentally stressful if you're not taking action on it, because it could kind of feel misaligned. That could lead to some existential grief and questions about like, what am I doing? And I think that's all really, really good to tune into and not numb out with a drink, but really kind of ask yourself, yeah, what am I doing? If there's a dose-dependent response here, if there's a history of these health issues in my family, or even if there's not a history of these issues, but we just know consuming alcohol increases the risk of these illnesses, and I do not want to get these illnesses, what am I doing with my behavior? And then I think maybe more compelling, obviously fear is a pretty compelling reason to stop or to diminish our alcohol intake. But I think what I find equally, if not more compelling, instead of like the avoidance of the fear and the disease, is the benefits and tuning into how good it can be on the other side. So even short term, even like in something like dry January or just damp January, very short term, you can lower your blood pressure, you can improve your insulin sensitivity. So let's say you're pre-diabetic or you have type 2 diabetes, that could be a big deal to improve or maybe even reverse your diabetic tendency there with improved insulin sensitivity. Your liver is really what processes the alcohol, and especially when you're drinking, alcohol is prioritized in the liver. So that's also, side note, something to know about, let's say, like food consumption. A lot of times I would find if I had a drink or two, I would just kind of be like, anything goes, let's order French fries at 10:30 p.m. And not only was it, you know, extra calories that I probably didn't need, but also those calories were just going to get put onto my body somewhere because my liver was going to prioritize filtering the alcohol first. So that's something to know too about drinking, and then maybe the kind of breaking the seal with food. Those can really add up together. And so the opposite of that, not drinking and letting your liver kind of really work on the things it needs to work on, lead to improvements in liver-related markers, which is great. Often if you're pre-diabetic or have type 2 diabetes, you might also have some signs of fatty liver disease, and you can reverse that through these behavior changes and drinking less. And of course, the sleep quality and quantity is going to improve. And honestly, I don't think we talk enough about sleep. I'm definitely going to be doing some kind of episode, if not episodes, on sleep as I continue through my sleep stress and recovery certification with Precision Nutrition, because I'm learning and applying so much. And as I sleep more and better, so quality and quantity, it's wild how improved my recovery has been and then how much better my gains in the gym have been. So, you know, anything we can do to improve our sleep and our recovery is going to improve absolutely everything in our lives, from our stress tolerance to then, because we're less stressed, our relationships, our work, our energy, our workouts. All of that is going to be an upward spiral if it can be improved. And one of the major ways to improve it is reducing alcohol. So, you know, I want to kind of take a little beat here to pause and encourage you to remember that, you know, taking a month off of drinking is not a detox that erases risk entirely. But what I think it is almost like how mindfulness is this little wedge. Let's say like you have a stressful moment at work and you, in that moment, remember to take a mindful moment, to take a deep breath in the nose, out the mouth. And as you kind of slow your system down, even just me just then, I realized how quickly I was talking. I calmed my nervous system a little bit. And if you can do that at a broader scale over, let's say, the month of January, it basically gives you this little mindfulness wedge that is long enough to just learn a little bit about your body, your habits, your sleep, your mood, and your stress response. And you might not realize, you might be kind of like me where you didn't feel that addicted to alcohol and your sleep seemed sort of normal. And in general, you considered yourself to have pretty good habits and to manage your stress somewhat mindfully. And then you might find, wow, this is harder than I thought it would be. Or, wow, these benefits are more significant than I expected. I don't really know what you'll find. Every person is going to be different. But I think what's important is giving yourself the opportunity through carving out the time and space to have some curiosity around it. And, you know, I'm talking about alcohol today, but this would go for anything. I think that's actually why I tend to like a short-term challenge, is not because any 30-day challenge is going to completely wipe the slate and help you become a new person. Absolutely not. That is not the purpose of a 30-day challenge. In my mind, when you engage in a 30-day challenge, what you're doing is saying, huh, I have some curiosity. Let's dip the big toe in. Let's tiptoe into this. Let's try on the identity of a person who fill in the blank. So in January, it might be, let's try on the identity of a person who doesn't drink alcohol. What does a person who doesn't drink alcohol do when they have a stressful day at work? What does a person who is sober do when they need to take the edge off? How does a sober, curious person socialize? Who do they surround themselves with and who do they not hang out with? What are the goals maybe of a person who's not drinking alcohol? Why would that matter? When a person is not drinking alcohol, what do they do with like the time and space that's freed up? How do they handle the thoughts and feelings that come up for them without maybe the crutch of numbing out with a drink? You know, those are all really useful things to try on. It might not mean that you want to do that forever. You might frankly find that you're not ready for it, like me a couple years ago, but it will still be valuable as a little self-experimentation. And, you know, you don't need to decide anything forever right now. That's one of the things I hate the most, actually, about the whole new year, new you, January 1st, rip off the Band-Aid. So in no way do I want you to walk away from this episode thinking, Becky says I need to be sober, I'm ripping off the Band-Aid and going cold turkey January 1st. That is not what I am saying. In fact, just to reiterate, remember, I tried dry January. I failed at dry January, but I didn't see that as a failure, because it was just an experiment. It was a test, or it wasn't a test, rather. It was an experiment to collect data. And any little bit helps, you know, even if it's a damp January. Risk reduction is also dose responsive. So just like the more you drink, the more risk you have, the more you reduce the dose, the fewer risks you have. And your body will be very responsive to this. And progress does not require perfection in either direction. So, you know, if you are thinking about this and you're kind of curious and you want to try it out, I would say one of the best things that I did for myself, especially the second time around, that helped, and this would be true for any goal, personally, I recommend this, is I educated myself about it more. So, you know, initially it was a little bit based on fear from that WHO report of there's no safe level. But then, you know, fear might get you started, but habits are what keep you going. And to even get to habits, I needed to kind of get to my deeper why, which are kind of those questions I was just asking, like, for a person who is sober, why? Why does it matter to them? And, you know, once you keep asking why several times, I think everybody will have their reason and that reason will be different for everybody. But then I think at that point, you're ready to try on some things and build some habits. So, you know, for me, the support system that I needed was educating myself, and the education that I needed came in the form of a few books. So I'll link to these in the show notes as well. I've done posts on them before. They're both the same author who is slipping my mind at the moment. Shame on me, but it'll be in the show notes. And the first book is just called Sober Curious. And it's more of a mindset first exploration of drinking less. And it's more kind of almost like the author's reflections on her own journey. And it's definitely more about curiosity, not deprivation. So I don't believe, if I remember right, I don't think she really is like a person who had a rock bottom moment. So if that's something too, that maybe you're like, well, I'm not a problem drinker, I don't really identify with all this, this book could probably be useful for you. And then her more recent book that helped when I really went at it again from like October onward, is the Sober Curious Reset. And this one's a little bit more structured, kind of like a daily devotional of sorts with like a 30-day reset with journaling prompts. I never really wrote out my prompts. Occasionally I do little bullet points and things, but I did find them very useful to just think about, because they would be kind of useful reflection prompts on those things that maybe we like to avoid thinking about. And, you know, I understand why. The stuff is not always easy. And just to reiterate, if you're feeling the pull to be a little bit curious about your relationship with alcohol, you don't have to quit forever. You don't have to do it perfectly. This would just be about trying it on and being a little curious and noticing what comes up for you. So if this episode resonated, and if you decide to try it for any length of time, even a few days or a week, or even just a damp January versus a dry January, I would absolutely love to hear about it. You can reach me at podcast@betterwithbecky.com. And in the meantime, thanks for joining me on this journey to a stronger self and a better life. See you next year.